Welcome to this week's episode of Off the Assembly Line. I'm your host, Rebecca Reed, and every week I sit down for possibility-sparking conversation with innovative educators and entrepreneurs who are bringing the future to education, one beautiful disruption at a time. Hey guys, so grateful to be back with you again with a brand new, inspiring conversation. I wanted to mention two things before we get going. The first is that I've been working with an amazing organization called kindness.org to develop a brand new kindness curriculum for K through 8th grade classrooms. It's a totally innovative approach to kindness and social emotional learning, and we're piloting with a limited number of schools this spring. If it sounds like something you want to get in on or know someone that should, check out the show notes to find out how to get more information or shoot me a message. The second thing is a reminder to register for the Education Innovation Virtual Town Hall taking place February 25th. The disconnect between education and workforce, community, the cutting edge, and beyond is real, and it's time to start bridging the gap. So we're starting with connection and conversation, and we're going to see where that takes us. Okay, now on to the episode. This week, I'm so excited to share a deeply insightful conversation with Dr. Robin Koslowitz, clinical psychologist, regular contributor to Psychology Today, and the education director and creator of Targeted Parenting Institute. We're talking about social emotional learning and the small tweaks that can make a major difference in students' well-being, behavior, and even long-term health and success. My favorite insight in our conversation is the innovative and integrated approach that Dr. Koslowitz uses, bridging the gap between home and school that is felt by many, but rarely addressed holistically. Like our recent mindfulness episodes, this conversation has wisdom for everyone. Let's get into it. Okay, so I'm here with Dr. Robin Koslowitz. Robin, thank you so much for joining me today.
Thank you so much for having me. I love your podcast.
Oh, awesome. And I love your work as well. It's been so fun to follow you and take part in those discussions.
Yeah, it's been, I've learned so much from the people I've connected with on LinkedIn. I never expected it to be as educational an experience as it has been.
Yeah, it's been kind of a surprising journey for me as well. But excited to chat with you today and talk about the parent-teacher-school connection and partnership to really strengthen students' overall growth and learning. So you work with both parents and educators to help them understand the inner workings of their kids. And I know you like to say that you help them hack their kids' challenges into superpowers, which I love. But as a clinical psychologist with more than 15 years of, and is it 15 years of research and working with children?
Yep. I actually started as a school psychologist back in 2002. But I was already in grad school starting to do this research in 1999. So yeah, it's been a long journey.
My goodness, yes. Okay, so after all that experience, what is the core message that you find yourself sharing with both educators and parents? If there is like a common thread, what has it been?
So I think that we're at a very interesting juncture in the education world right now where we're starting to really understand that if we don't work on the social and emotional and self-regulation competencies with kids, we really can't effectively educate them. Mm-hmm. And which has never been the case before. We've been, you know, talking about social and emotional learning and things like that, you know, over the years, of course, have always been school counselors and things like that. But it's gone from a really nice bonus to absolute necessity. And very rapidly, I think that shift has occurred.
So if I can kind of dig into that a little bit, what is the crux of that necessity, or like where does the rubber meet the road in terms of SEL and academic outcomes, for example?
I think we're seeing more and more that kids are coming to school grappling with like real life problems and not having brains that are really like primed for learning right now. And more teachers are being asked to step in and intervene with those things. And as teachers are becoming more educated about SEL, but also more educated about how important it is to engage hearts as well as minds, the teachers themselves are saying, wait, I need tools in order to do this. It can't just be told, do it, right? It has to be, there has to be, someone has to give me a roadmap for what I'm doing, what is considered overstepping my bounds as a teacher, what's considered the right level of intervention. We have an entire class here of kids who came in not ready to learn for whatever is going on in their homes or in the community. And what do I do with that? Before I even teach math, I have to teach children, right? And I'm not really being taught how to teach children.
Okay, so we're kind of going really deep, really fast, which I love. So if I could pull another onion layer back a little bit and ask, you know, teachers are asking for resources. Now they're having to meet the needs, you know, for students that go well beyond maybe what they're told to expect coming in. What then is the connection or the gap when it comes to home involvement or parent involvement? And by gap, I just mean really the disconnect. What's the disconnect there?
So I think the disconnect comes on multiple levels. It's a great question because it's something I've been thinking about a lot and something I've been asking parents in focus groups a lot. You know, there's a few different levels of disconnect. There's the disconnect level of teachers feeling that this is a very litigious society and they have to be careful what they do or don't say because everyone walks around with basically a mini recording studio in their back pocket, right? So I have to be super careful, you know, about exactly what I do and don't say to a teacher because I've been warned by administration to like refine my message. And then we have parents who feel that the school is not always getting the reality of where their kid's at or what their kid needs. And then we have the kids themselves who are very different learners than they were even 10 years ago. And the kids themselves, like going back to their parents and saying like, I just can't stay engaged as long as, you know, as long as this teacher is asking me to stay engaged or, you know, this feels too pressuring or I'm being bothered on the playground. How can I focus on science when, you know, I know I'm going out to that playground again, right? So there's this disconnect where the parents are not necessarily feeling heard by the school and the teachers, and the teachers are having to be very careful with how they interact with the parents and not, you know, not being allowed always to take as much responsibility as they would want, but also not having the resources to, because if there's 20 kids in a class and one teacher and you know, five of them are going through something, that's a lot of one-on-one time to spend. So the teachers are, I feel like, being asked sometimes to overpromise or, you know, to do a lot of roles, and then understandably, then the parent feels the kid's being shortchanged, the kid feels, you know, shortchanged, and the teacher feels like, how can I possibly do this with 20 children?
Super complex, because on one hand, we have a challenge around transparency and communication for a lot of different reasons. And then on the other hand, we have requirements that go beyond what many educators feel like they're prepared to meet or were even expecting to begin with. As we begin to start to address some of these challenges and some of those disconnects, can you just kind of paint a picture of the work that you're doing with Targeted Teaching Institute, Targeted Parenting Institute, and what that looks like kind of on the ground level?
Yeah, so when I started Targeted Parenting and I started Targeted Teaching, the reason for that, I started Targeted Parenting first, and then I realized that there was this disconnect where I might teach a parent a certain way of approaching problems with their kids, or when I would go to a school and give a workshop, I might teach kids certain social competencies and skills, but, you know, and then we would send home a little note explaining what the kids learned and whatever, and we weren't finding that the parents were doing a ton of buy-in, and sometimes even it was comical, like we would have a workshop about dealing with social aggression, and then a parent would call the school 2 weeks later and say something like, my daughter is, you know, feeling that kids in her class are being mean to her, and how come you're not doing anything about it? And we had this like, well, why didn't you read the note we sent home 2 weeks ago, and we gave you all these extension activities that you could do with your kid, and, you know, so we felt like, how are we not getting this message across? So we came to the realization that the best way to do this, if we really want to transform a school culture, really want to transform even one particular grade level, the best way to do it is to have ongoing workshops with the teachers, the students, and the parents, like three separate workshops, where everybody hears the same message at the same time, so that we're all using the same vocabulary and we all are using the same skills and we're all talking the same language about it. So then all of a sudden, the parents are very much on board because they can ask questions, and because the way I set up targeted parenting and targeted teaching is that it is external to the school. Like, we are coming in as external consultants as opposed to being internal to the school. The parents feel more safe asking questions and bringing things up and, you know, exploring things where it doesn't become an administrative issue. But also, when I can respond to a question, I'm not responding, you know, about a specific situation that happened in, you know, like, you know, Miss Adams' fifth grade class. It's more like, let's understand fifth graders and let's understand how fifth graders think about social skills so that we don't get into that situation where the parent is, you know, getting very like demanding about something, or the parent is getting or feeling very frustrated because there's a buffer zone, right? There's somebody to talk to, and there's a place to process it and stay and keep focused in the problem solving mode. Like, if the parent's frustrated with a particular teacher, this is a place where we can focus on solutions. And so that emotion of the frustration kind of transforms into, so let's figure this out together. Like, we're here in this room, we're all these moms, let's all together come up with a solution. Let's remember the skills we taught our kids, and let's all together come up with something that we're going to do. It really does provide a great buffer for everybody. Same thing with the teachers. When we're doing focus groups with teachers, it's great because the teachers also, you know, they can sometimes say things that are frustrating them, and then we can push to problem solving mode. You know, so it feels much safer for everybody concerned.
That's really, really smart. And you know what I was going to ask you? What is the special sauce of this kind of integrated workshop model? And I don't know if you would say that it's this buffer kind of dynamic, but yeah, I that's something I didn't even consider when I was thinking about why this would be so powerful. Is that the special sauce, that there is kind of a buffer zone that sort of de-escalates the emotions that are involved to start with? Or would you say there's something else?
Well, I think there's also the buffer zone. I think that's one of the special sauces. I think there's also the buffer zone of when we do a workshop, even if we're dealing with a class, let's say where there's a bullying problem or a class queen problem or, you know, any of those dynamics, or a kid who's just very loud and sort of taking over the class, and, you know, more introverted kids are feeling, you know, like overshadowed. I think that the buffer zone is also that particular child. The parent of that child doesn't feel singled out. We are doing this workshop with everybody, because if we have one child who's having a problem with that, everybody's going to have to at some point learn how to deal with that, right? So it's not like just, you know, Sarah, you know, who's becoming problematic. It's, you know, it's not that one kid. It's everybody in the class needs to learn a skill called dealing with conflict, right? Everyone in the class needs to learn a skill called accepting a no. Right. So that way it's not this like one kid's being singled out, which right away like lowers what I call mama bear syndrome on the part of the parents. Mm-hmm. And also keeps us very focused on, okay, so instead of it being like this kid is a problem, we have this rule that people can't be problems. Problems are problems. Right. So it's not like this one kid is a problem. There's a problematic interaction in this classroom. We all need to learn skills, how to handle it. It takes away the onus on anyone. I think that's a big part of the secret sauce. The other big part of the secret sauce that works, first of all, is in our lean startup model, doing the focus groups with teachers, the way we built our curriculum was, you know, sitting down with teachers in schools and saying, like, what are the problems coming up in your classrooms? What are the social and emotional regulation skills your students need? And then a teacher would talk about an incident, and then we would then pinpoint that to a, oh, you know what that skill is called? That skill is called getting curious about other people, right? And then we would turn it into something. That skill is called accepting a no. Oh, that skill is called conserving energy, right? And then that would build into lessons. Some lessons remained very situation specific, and they kind of went into like my other resources file for if it ever comes up again in a school. And sometimes as I'm doing focus groups school after school after school, I'll find that like all the fifth grade teachers across like 15 different schools are saying the same thing about their fifth graders. Okay, then that lesson has to be in the core curriculum, because clearly this is a fifth grade developmental need. We have to learn this skill, right? And then that's how lessons go from the, you know, they go from the like sort of possibly a lesson we tried it in a classroom into a, this is part of the core curriculum, now we're doing this. But another part of the secret sauce is also that because I facilitate the workshops right now myself and I have the teachers observe and help out, the teachers get to really keep an eye on the social dynamic of their students and really keep an eye. I ask them, I give them like questionnaires and things to fill out, observation sheets, as they're watching the kids, and they get to really notice the social undercurrents among the students because they're not teaching, they're observing. So they get to really see sometimes the kid who seems confident, but actually when you watch her from the back of the classroom participating in an activity, she's actually pretty insecure. Or, you know, the boy who seems, you know, to be very, you know, very quiet and not part of things, but actually is a hidden leader. And they really start to notice those kids. And it really helps inform how they're going to work with their students in the future because they start really getting the undercurrents.
It's so interesting that there's this thread of like a primary separation from like my own reaction, my own feelings, my own fears, you know, or biases, whatever they might be, on the part of the adults that are in this process, whether that's educators, whether that's parents. A lot of what you're doing is kind of stepping in and saying, it's reminding me of kind of mindfulness practice, honestly. A lot of it is like, let's pause. And let's become aware of what's going on inside of our own bodies. And now let's start to ideate some great solutions here. It's occurring to me that I had been thinking about this initially in terms of like a two-way partnership between parents and schools, parents and leaders, you know, parents, or I should say parents and school leaders, or parents and teachers and administrators. So I was seeing those two entities working in this partnership. But as you're talking, it's really clear that it's more of this triad. The students are active partners in all of these solutions and all of this learning as well. What does it look like for students to be an active partner rather than kind of just in the midst of the adults in the room?
So definitely when I do a workshop, it's very participatory. I do a lot of things that are like almost like adult corporate team building events, but with little kids that can be done in a school auditorium. And it's very participatory. And I'm very into saying to the kids that this is about our process. This is about our emotions. It's not about the right answer. It's about the authentic answer that, you know, really encapsulates your values. And even like third graders can understand that concept. The kids love having, first of all, being given specific tools of how to handle certain things. It gives them a lot of a sense of empowerment. Like in one activity I did, we were talking about communication, and I had the kids, I asked them to show me without words that they were interested in what I had to say, right? So they all like straightened up, and, you know, looked at me, which is something you can do even with four-year-olds. And I pointed out to them that, you know, sometimes a teacher will call on one kid in particular and it doesn't feel fair to other kids. Like, why am I not being called on? And we came up with this idea that we can non-verbally communicate with our teachers that we're really interested, that we really want to participate in the conversation. And, you know, one kid put it like, we can sparkle our eyes at the teacher. And, you know, like, and I was like, right, we can. And then that became now our term, like sparkly eyes. You know, like if someone's giving me sparkly eyes, I'm going to call on them because they look engaged. So we're going away from that feeling of like, my teacher has favorites. My as one kid said in one workshop, she said, well, my teacher only calls on the cute kids and I'm not one of the cute kids, which is a really painful thing to hear, right? Like, you know, although it was nice that she felt safe enough to say that, and being able to say to her, well, maybe it's not the cuteness so much as it's the engagement and the smile and the body language and the eye sparkling. Can you try that? And which was feedback she got from other kids, you know, like, let's try this. And yeah, we got to this whole problem solving mode, like, oh, you can actually influence your teacher. Your teacher isn't only influencing you. And she went back to class and we tried it. And she came back the next week and she said, and I was sparkling my eyes at the teacher and she kept calling on me, like it worked. You know, like, I mean, it helped that the teacher was there. So she heard that. So she was like sensitized and clued in that right. I need to be calling on this kid. But then, you know, doing that workshop with her mother, being able to get her mother was the parent who came into the workshop, being able to help her mother understand that her daughter has power. We can always influence people. And we have a self-limiting belief, like, I'm not one of the cute kids, which is like, ouch, right? Like, I don't want a fifth grader walking around thinking that. But being able to focus her on, well, what are the things you can do to change the situation, right? What are, do you actually wield any power in this situation? And focusing her back on problem solving just got this child out of, I mean, imagine her going through life and having this sensation of, I'm not one of the cute kids, mm-hmm. and therefore I'm not worthy of attention, right? That's something that might have been, had to been addressed in, like, you know, serious long-term psychotherapy in 10th grade, where now she's like having a whole different take on it in fifth grade, and hopefully, you know, and hopefully handling and addressing the problem.
Yeah, it's really powerful. So that kind of leads me to another question. You know, as you're doing this, I'm calling it an integrated approach, but what do you call it? This kind of trio of workshops?
I call it, it's interesting because I use the same term, I call it an integrated school culture transformation.
Oh, nice. Okay.
And we get the parents to buy in. And the whole idea is we're all using the same vocabulary. It is the cutest thing for me when I hear my vocabulary being used. Like, one of the things, one of the first lessons I very frequently do in like the third grade is this concept of levels of energy and communication. I actually have a clip of me teaching that lesson on my website where I use Mo Willems' books. He has these great books, this character pigeon mm-hmm. and this character duckling. And I teach the concept of levels of energy and communication, right? Like, pigeon uses way too much energy. He begs for things and, you know, he wants to drive a bus and you have to yell no at him. And it's a lot of fun to like go through the story. Kids love doing it. And then there's Duckling, who very politely asks for a cookie and uses the right amount of energy and gets what he wants. And kids will tell you straight out, like, we know pigeons and ducklings. Like, we will ask the kid who's the duckling to be the one to ask the teacher for extra recess because she's probably going to get a yes. Like, third graders get this. But now that they have a vocabulary for it, and we use also analogy of like a balloon. If it's filled up with just the right amount of air, then that balloon, it comes from an old counseling game that I used to use when I was a school counselor. You know, you want to fill the balloon up with just the right amount of air. You don't want to pop the balloon and use too much energy, because if you exhaust the listener, then the listener is going to be burnt out, and then they're just not going to have energy for anything else you ask for. So you might get a yes that one time if you beg and beg and beg, but then you're going to get 15 no's after that. Is it worth it? And once kids have that sense of being a pigeon or a duckling, it becomes part of the vocabulary. And when the parents get that language, then they can talk about it. So, you know, I had a mom tell me that her daughter, they were in a store and there was a customer who was being extremely demanding, and you know, and the cashier was getting really frustrated. And ultimately they said to this customer, we can't help you. And this little, you know, third grader turns to her mom and she said, Ma, that lady was acting like a pigeon. She should have asked like a duckling, right? And it was so great that everybody got this vocabulary. Like, everybody now understands this concept of like, I can change the way I communicate. And if I change the way I communicate, the likelihood of me getting my request fulfilled goes much higher. I've had moms say to me like, you know, I've been communicating with the school a little bit like a pigeon. I think I better like try really hard to fix it. And it's like, yes, exactly. Or I have another term of get curious, and like, I even have a teacher in a focus group say to me something like, you know, so, and then my son was acting really rude to me, right? She's just chit-chatting, and she, you know, at the beginning of the focus group, and she'll say, and you know, my son was just acting so obnoxious, and he came home from school, and he had a chip on his shoulder. I don't know what was going on with him. So I decided to get curious. I'm like, yes, this has entered the vernacular. Like, we're all talking about the same skill. You know, a kid will say to another kid, I was observing a recess interaction, and one girl was very upset because she was, you know, excluded from a game, and she went and told her friend, I think it was either her friend or her sister, she went to tell another kid on the playground, and the kid said, well, did you get curious why they said that to you? And here are two kids giving each other real-time, real-life feedback, which of course then eases the strain on the teacher who's observing, you know, who's supervising recess, because the kids themselves are problem solving their interactions. Mm-hmm. So we reserve, you know, our resources a little bit.
Yeah, I love that. And I also love kind of these sticky visuals that you're giving them to hang on to, which again, I don't know why I keep poking at this, but it again goes back to a little bit of that separation, and you've written some about this, you know, you've had some discussions around the labeling challenge, you know, right, and whether this is helpful or harmful and those kinds of things. But I, you know, I'm kind of seeing myself notice that in a lot of what you're doing with students and with parents and educators, you're giving language that helps them to envision behaviors, feelings, conditions, dynamic relationships that are a little bit separate from their full identities, which of course makes it a lot easier to learn how to manage them in ways that are really helpful.
People to understand that there are skills in human interaction in the same way that there are skills like math or science, and that if we can and we can learn those skills, we're never powerless. There are always skills we can learn. The big one, I think, the question, I'm pretty pro certain types of labels. I think it's very helpful. I feel like humans label, right? Like if a child is sitting in class and he's constantly calling out and getting out of his seat and being really disruptive, if the teacher doesn't know that he carries a diagnosis of ADHD, she's going to label him in her head as lazy or unmotivated or rude, right? Like humans label. It's part of being a human, right? It's better to have a more realistic functional label that helps us get at the problem. Whereas other labels, like when we label people as problematic, right, then that becomes a serious problem. Like, I have a problem with labeling a kid a bully. I'd much rather talk about bullying behavior, right? Because once you label a kid a bully, it's like, okay, forget him, right? When we label a kid, you know, this kid is the bully of the class, this kid habitually engages in bullying behavior. Now we have to teach him and the rest of the class what to do when that kind of dynamic happens. That seems to me much more helpful because, again, it's a functional definition, right? Because people can't be problems. Problems can be problems. Mm-hmm. I find that because parents, which is so understandable, if a parent themselves was bullied, or if you're watching your kid be bullied, it's so painful, it's so hard, it's so tempting to lash out, you know, to get really upset at the school, at the teacher, my kid is in pain, you need to fix it, right? But when we refocus the parent back to let's teach skills, because unfortunately, human nature is your child for the rest of his life is going to meet up with people who use aggression as their habitual way of interacting with other people, right? Those people exist in the world. Let's teach him how to deal with it now in fifth grade, right? In a controlled, happy environment, not when he's like 22 and, you know, and in college and doesn't have that kind of, you know, supervision and scaffolding and help and it could really be a big problem. Let's teach him now. Let's give him the skill. Mm-hmm. Right, like we could kick the other kid out of the class, but all we're doing is, of course, kicking the problem into a different classroom. Right, we're not really fixing anything. Rather, let's teach your son right now what to do, and let's teach every other child in the class how to handle it when an interaction like this happens. And let's all have the same vocabulary: mom, dad, teacher, principal, kids in the class, people who he passes in the hallway. We all are going to call things by the same names, so that when it happens. I'm just going to give you my own personal story, my own history. When I was a child, I was bullied by a class queen. And, I used to do these anti-bullying workshops all the time. And so even though I have my own personal experience with bullying, I still believe that there's no such thing as a bully, right? There's people who engage in bullying behavior who need to be taught otherwise. Because I firmly believe a lot of times schools call me and ask me to help them like craft the zero tolerance policy. I do a lot of school consultation work outside of targeted parenting and targeted teaching. And like, I do a lot of helping schools craft policies and, you know, craft better ways of handling problem situations. And I'm really against zero tolerance policies because how do they help, right? Mm-hmm. Like, all we're doing is kicking the whole situation into another classroom, right? Instead, we have to intervene. We have to teach everybody how to handle it. Because I know in my situation when I was bullied, the girls who used to help the class queen, so to speak, you know, her like little, you know, the court, the bully helpers, as we call them, those girls didn't have the vocabulary to ask their parents for help with the situation because they didn't have names for what was going on. So I remember very clearly, I got a phone call 30 years later after this incident happened. A woman called me and she said, "Do you remember me? We were in elementary school together." And I said, "Yeah, I remember you." And she said, "I'm calling to apologize because do you remember that one time I threw you off the bus? Like you were on the top step of the bus and I shoved you and you fell off the bus. I don't know why I did that." And we had a conversation about it. And I said, I know why you did that, because there was this, you know, class queen who, you know, encouraged you to do that. And we had this whole very rich conversation about what that, you know, what that year in our schooling was like. And she told me, and it was so interesting, she went to her mother and she said, you know, I pushed my friend off the bus today. And her mother said, oh, she hurt herself. I'm going to, like, let's buy her a gift and you can apologize for accidentally pushing her. And that wasn't really what she was asking her mother, right? She intentionally pushed me, but she didn't have the vocabulary to say it, and her mother didn't have the vocabulary to hear it. So she held on. I mean, think about this. For 30 years, she held on to this feeling of guilt of, like, why did I do that? How could I have hurt somebody? I pushed her off the bus. What was I thinking? For 30 years, it bothered her. And I know it bothered her for 30 years, because in 30 years later, she called me up.
Right.
So that means she held on to that. I don't want my child holding on to that kind of uncomfortable, ambivalent feeling for 30 years. Mm-hmm. I want her to have the vocabulary to tell me in the moment exactly what happened, to have the words for it. You know, so it's so important. We can't just give the kids the vocabulary, because then the parents won't have the ears to hear it unless we give the parents the vocabulary and the teachers the vocabulary. Everybody's got to be talking in the same terminology so that we can help kids and really, you know, and really help them not just learn a skill, but use the skill and notice the need for that skill. And, you know, and just another, you know, and this is a really nice story, because for me, I feel like, you know how we have to sometimes give meaning to things that we suffered? So I do this workshop, I call it throwing the ball back, where, you know, we're sort of playing tennis with what I call a tricky comment. It's a comment that someone makes where you're not sure if it was meant to be bullying or not, you know? So, you know, that kind of thing where, like, you know, I love your skirt. My little sister has one just like it. Where you don't know, was that bullying? Was she giving me a genuine compliment? So I teach them this concept of playing tennis, where you just throw the ball back. You keep having a volley. So you say something like, thanks, you know, and you see where it goes. You might agree. You might turn it into a joke. There's a whole bunch of options. Right after I did that workshop with a seventh grade in a school, the class was having, the school, the girls, I don't remember what was happening, there was some sort of a club that was setting up for like a, it was like a state fair, and the kids were setting up these displays, and everybody was gonna, you know, present about the state that they were teaching. And one girl, I think she had, I'm gonna say Nebraska or you know, one of the corn growing states. So she was gonna give out candy corn. Everybody had to give out a prize having to do with their state. So she was gonna give out candy corn. And another girl, who probably was very unconscious of how intimidating she was, said to her, oh, you're giving out candy corn, like in this very sneering tone. And the girl said, yep, that's what I'm giving out. And all the children in the class, right, every single kid who was standing around watching this said, hey, you just played tennis. And the first girl said, you know, the girl who had made that sneering comment said, wait, I made a tricky comment. I said something hurtful. I didn't know. I'm sorry. And then the second girl felt so empowered, because everybody acknowledged it. Everybody noticed it. And instead of being intimidated by that comment, she was empowered and she just was able to answer. And for me, it was the most transformative experience of watching it. And then that night, that was one of the first times we actually did a parenting group. And we talked about that incident. And we talked about the concept of tennis and empowering kids. So that before we're even going down the who's the bully, who's creating the social aggression, let's teach everybody. Then everybody knows, because then the dynamic doesn't happen. Mm. And the fact that all the teachers knew this and that everybody in the school knew this meant that, like, everybody was, you know, commenting when kids were, you know, throwing balls back. Everyone was commenting when kids were getting curious. Everybody was using the same vocabulary. It just, we went from a school, in that particular school, where parents were really not on the same page with administration and teachers for a variety of, like, internal reasons, to parents who were so on the same page. And I think one of the best transformations was calling the school to give, you know, to give positive feedback of, like, I noticed my daughter using this skill. I noticed my daughter using that skill. I used it myself and it was really helpful. We just transformed the culture into, like, we're all on the same page with this stuff. And, like, it was just the most, for me, it was just the most, you know, beautiful thing to see.
It's so powerful, and it is an innovative approach, right? Like, I at least am not familiar with this very holistic, very intentionally holistic approach to what you're doing. I'm curious, I feel like if this were a simpler thing to do, it may have been popping up all over the place. Who knows? I don't know. So I imagine there are some challenges that you encounter in helping schools pull this kind of learning together. What would some of those barriers be that you really have to help them overcome?
So first of all, we have to, of course, schools have limited resources, and we have to really get people on board with allocating resources to this. What I find really helps is when principals who have already used it saying, like, you know, actually, you cannot imagine the amount of resources doing this has freed up, because I am not spending my day policing fight after fight after fight and politics, and I'm just not dealing with those phone calls anymore, which frees up my time in so many other ways. You know, the challenge for me is scaling, which, because a lot of schools will say, can you just send us the lessons? And I just had this experience, I had this conversation this morning with one of the schools I consult for, where she said, how come when you were doing the workshops or one of your facilitators was doing the workshops, it worked so well, but when we asked you for the curriculum, we tried to have the classroom teacher implement it herself, it didn't work, and we want it back. We want to go back to the old way of a facilitator. And I pointed out, because we were missing that secret sauce of, there's a facilitator who's external and the teacher who's the coach and who's, you know, observing and, you know, understanding classroom dynamic.
That buffer.
We need the buffer. And the curriculum, the lessons are great, but I mean, there's thousands of lessons on social and emotional learning in the world.
Absolutely.
It's not the lesson plans. That was never the magic ingredient here, right? That was never it. It was this idea of having that external person who is coming in to refocus everybody on solving the problem of social and emotional learning, solving the problem of self-regulation and student interaction. With that, as you're putting it, I love that term, that buffer zone, right? That's the secret sauce. We can't do it with just the lesson plans. Don't do it. I'm experimenting with doing this via webinar where I'll do this remotely with the classroom. I'm giving the workshop from far away. I actually do cute things because I like to throw prizes at kids as we're doing the workshop. If someone sparkles her eyes at me or answers something really well, I'll throw like a keychain or a pen, like cute little prizes. And like, I'll throw the keychain like at the computer screen, and then the teacher will like throw the same prize, you know, to the kid. So it feels very interactive. And which is, you know, fun. So we're experimenting with doing that way. I've also, you know, trained a lot of facilitators so that they can come into the school and be the buffer. Sometimes we train the school counselor and she becomes the facilitator. Unfortunately, it's like almost criminal that we have one school counselor for 500 kids is like the statistic now, which is ridiculous. My mother, who was possibly one of the wisest school counselors I know, was a school guidance counselor her whole professional career. She was the guidance counselor of the year in New York City one year. She was amazing. She sparked my interest in doing all of this. To me, it's criminal that we don't have enough school counselors and school psychologists. But training school counselors to do this, or training, like I said, an outside facilitator to do this, frees up resources to such an extent that, you know, the schools can't even believe it when they see it, like to the extent that the principal is not troubleshooting and troubleshooting and troubleshooting, you know, the dean of discipline isn't like breaking up fights all day long, you know, like that. It so helps in terms of freeing up resources so that everybody can do what they specialize in.
Mm-hmm. Well, because you're getting down to root causes rather than continually treating symptoms that reappear and reappear and reappear.
Exactly.
And so I probably should have asked this in the very beginning, but do you bundle what you're doing in schools under the umbrella of social emotional learning? As you talk to schools, is that how you're framing this work, or is it something else?
Well, some schools have it under social emotional learning. A lot of schools, whether they're mandated by their state or whether they themselves feel strongly about it, do it under like harassment, intimidation, and bullying. Because this does get to the root of bullying way before bullying becomes bullying. If we teach that, you know, that kid who in ninth grade is absolutely engaging in bullying behaviors and shaking down little kids and just like really doing like what we call the old school typical bullying type behavior that we picture when we picture that, If we teach him in first grade what to do with his negative emotions and how to self-regulate, and in third grade we teach him how to, you know, ask for things like a duckling instead of a pigeon, and in fifth grade we talk about undercurrents in social dynamics, right? And like we're progressing. We don't have that ninth grade bully anymore, right? Unless, of course, obviously that's very idealistic. There are some children who, you know, we have that, you know, thing that, you know, hurt people, and you know, there are children who come from homes that are, you know, abusive. And those children do need individualized therapy that will help them. But for many children who aren't, who just have intense emotions because that's their temperament and that's how they came, you know, that's how, you know, as one mother said, that's how he came from the store, you know, like he came like this from the box, you know. You know, some kids are intense. When we teach them and they do have a supportive home environment, then we're really cutting down on those later problems that do become the provenance then of the, you know, of the, whether it becomes the, you know, the job of the mental health system or it becomes the job of the criminal justice system. We're going to cut down on the kids that end up going through that pipeline.
Mm-hmm. It's such crucial work right now, and it feels like it's only growing in urgency day by day.
There's another point I wanted to make. You know, listening to your podcast, I've always felt this, but listening to your podcast really convinced me to the next level of how true this is. You know, there are so many things that used to be so many areas and domains that used to be the job of the teacher that now are changing, right? Like, you know, you've had so many people on talking about different apps that like can really be used in the classroom. There are so many things that can be taught now with assistive technology, right? That this is the one thing that teachers can still do. You can't learn social and emotional skills from a computer screen. We can watch a nice movie, you know, discuss a movie like Inside Out and learn something about emotions, but we can't really learn that human interaction and like, how do I handle hurt feelings? You know, my friend is sad, what do I do about it? We can't really do that without another human guiding us and teaching us through that. I think most of us go into the field of education. I know I went into the field of education because we wanted to be that person that made that real impact on a kid. And the fact is that when educational technology frees up our time so that we can be that guiding light in that kid's life and teach them this emotional wisdom that they can have for life, that's why we went into education in the first place. Mm. You know, that, you know, I say that's not teaching, that's educating. You know, like that's what we want to do. We all went into education for that. Very few people go into education because they think, like, I have a passion for explaining, you know, algebraic equations, and, like, that's why I'm teaching. Most people go into teaching because I really like kids, and I want to help kids, and I want to connect with kids.
You know, as you're sharing this, I'm just thinking that, you know, it's so important for us to understand and frame the technology question or the technology conversation in a way where we understand that technology is there to serve the humans. Like, it's there to serve the human practice, the human experience, the human learning. And so the best technological solutions in schools right now are the ones that take away the things that are too heavy and missing the point for educators to begin with, to take that off the plate and to clarify some things and really empower them to do the things that they want to do in the first place and that, you know, to do the things that are truly powerful through the learning experience. Disseminating information is not powerful, and we don't need that. We don't need to be burdened by that anymore. We have such wonderful tools that can do that and that have freed up they have freed people up to learn in new and incredible ways, but they can't give the context. They can't teach analytical thinking. They can't teach critical thinking. It can't teach relational skills. It can't do all of the things that you need as a human being to put any of that information into practice. And so I think that's part of the balance. But that's exactly what you're getting at, you know, in kind of striking at that balance. Curious, kind of getting back to, the model that you're bringing to schools and some of that magic in the buffer zone and giving a common language and really giving a holistically common language, you know, I always want to ask our guests, you know, for the model that you're building and for the educators and the parents that are listening right now, or even school leaders, administrators, what are some of the ways they can translate what is so powerful in your practice to their schools right now?
So I really do believe it's a great question. I really believe in the power of outside consultants and having someone external to the system create the buffer zone and understand that schools are systems. And on the one hand, we can't not serve a child, but on the other hand, we can't strain the system too much for the needs of one child. There has to be an outside person who doesn't have, you know, so to speak, doesn't have a stake in this game, so to speak, so much, who can look at it with a very clear eye and help everybody get on the same page. It's so important. It's also super important for if a teacher does decide to do a social and emotional learning lesson, if something really cool comes up in class, a debate about something, it's so important for the teacher to like educate the parents what happened. I think sometimes schools, you know, err on the side of caution with educating the parents about what happened because they do worry that there are those parents who are going to get, you know, angry or triggered or something. But it's so useful to say, you know, we had this really interesting debate about the concept of fairness in our third grade classroom today. Here's what we came up with, and please discuss it with your kid and send back some information, you know, like send back your own response with your child, like start that dialogue, get everybody, you know, talking about these things. Let's not be afraid to talk to each other.
Absolutely.
Like, it's not just, you know, your daughter got into a fight, your son got into a fight, somebody was being mean to your kid didn't eat lunch. You know, we don't only want to have your kid didn't bring in her homework, you know, we don't always want to have that conversation with the parent. I think, you know, it's great nowadays, it's so easy with schools having, you know, websites and schools having voicemail boxes that teachers leave messages to, you know, educate the parents about the social and emotional things that went on that day. There's always something, right? There's always, we read a story in literature and there was and the character experienced a dilemma. We learned something in science that's analogous to, you know, emotional education, right? We learned something in, you know, we learned something, somebody got frustrated in class today and then we handled it really well. You know, there's always news about the social and emotional realm that we can bring parents in on. Do you have any, you know, do you have any wisdom to share with us about this topic? You know, talking to kids, I find in one of the components of every workshop I do is I ask kids a think question, which is, you know, I ask them very large social, like, so almost social justice type questions, like the definition of fear. Like, is fear everyone gets the same thing? Is fear everyone gets what they need? Is fear everyone gets what they deserve? And we have this like debate about it because there's merit to each one of those arguments, right? Bring that home to the parents, ask the parent, like, you know, we discussed this concept in social studies today. Do you have anything to add to contribute to our discussion? Right? Can you record a little video about your reaction? Can you send us some information? You know, get the parents involved, make it a conversation.
I think that's super wise. And I have just kind of a follow-up question. It's not a follow-up question. It's a little bit of a non sequitur. It's kind of an adjacent question. Kind of one level below that. So I'm picturing the handoff, right, between parents and guardians and teachers. So I'm picturing the handoff in the school drop-off where, you know, students leaving their homes and getting on the bus or driving to school. I'm imagining that this handoff, this transition from home to school. What is maybe the most important thing or the most important practice that parents can do in the home to get their kids ready, quote unquote, ready for school? And then the follow-up would be, what then is the most important thing across the board that teachers can do to help receive students well, to help continue that readiness in the classroom or recreate that readiness as they walk into the classroom? And if that's too much of a deep dive at this point, that's okay too. I just find myself curious.
I mean, I feel like, first of all, we have to remember that not every parent is ready to engage in conscious parenting, right? Some parents are very overstressed. Some parents are, you know, coping with very real life stressors that are very, very, very large. And although sometimes I will say that even a parent who's in an extremely stressful situation, when they're when their mind is open to simple things they can do to do some conscious parenting, they very often, when the problem is not so much not caring, it's feeling disempowered. And when we point out that there are certain things you can do that really will work, then that sense of empowerment is like, you know what, even if I'm stressed out, I have limited resources, I work two jobs, I'm a single parent, my life is very stressful, but you know, this simple thing I can actually do because it'll work, that just gives the parent a sense of empowerment. So for example, I'm very into this concept of a digital bedtime, right? And getting enough sleep. We all need enough sleep. Hmm. Some kids have hungry brains and it's really hard to sleep because, you know, we just want to know more and more and more. Certainly our phones are not our friends when it comes to this. So sometimes just simply empowering parents about, like, if you're only going to do one thing, get your kid to sleep. Don't let them have a smartphone in their room. I know I do a lot of therapy groups with kids who are actually, you know, in therapy, meaning they have a diagnosis. And some of them describe a night that sounds like a night with a newborn baby, where they sleep with their smartphone under their pillow. So every time there's a notification on their Facebook, Instagram, I mean, like, you know, the amount of platforms they're on seems endless, then they can, like, you know, like, wake up and, like, you know, answer it and then go back to sleep and doze off. That's the kind of sleep you get with a newborn baby. That's not real sleep. That you're never getting into deep sleep. You're never restoring your brain. So first of all, I like to educate the kids about this, explain to them very clearly why sleep is so important. I have all sorts of analogies about, like, your brain cleaning itself up as you sleep. And, you know, we have a whole visual thing we do. Educating the parents about that, like, you're not being cruel and unusual if you say to your kid, no, I'm confiscating your smartphone, or I'm shutting off the Wi-Fi signal to our house at 10 o'clock at night. Turn it back on tomorrow morning.
Let me just press on that for a minute. Can you, let's just assume that everyone's coming in fresh to this, and you mentioned our brains cleaning itself as they sleep. Can you just very quickly explain the importance of a digital bedtime and what's going on there?
Well, we need deep sleep, right? Neuroscience shows that as we're in our deep, our brain cycles between, you know, light sleep, REM sleep, and deep sleep. During REM sleep, we dream, right? It's called rapid eye movement sleep. That's the part of sleep, basically, this is a major oversimplification, but basically that's the part we're dreaming because all, I call it like our little thought bubbles, like all the little thought bubbles that are in the front part of our brain have to be kind of zoom to the back part of our brain where there are filing cabinets for them. Mm-hmm. Inside Out does a great job. The movie Inside Out does a great job of visually depicting how that sort of could look, right? So if we don't get into REM sleep and we don't get into deep sleep, then during REM sleep, those memories are getting processed and are getting sort of brought to the back part of your brain. During deep sleep, they're getting sorted into their respective filing cabinets. If we don't get enough sleep, then that information is never going to get sorted. The front part of our brain is going to remain cluttered, and then it won't be available to help us regulate emotions the next day and regulate attention the next day because it's cluttered, just like a desk that's cluttered. You know, you can't see what's on it. So teaching that to kids and to parents, and also I find empowering parents, there are kids who successfully convince their parents that it's cruel to take their phones away at night. Like, that's just, I've even heard it's cruel and unusual punishment. Like, you know, I don't know. I grew up, there were no smartphones, and I didn't feel tortured by that. You know, like, you know, or, you know, I had a kid whose mom, you know, was, you know, appropriately monitoring some online, you know, Facebook stuff, or I don't remember, Instagram stuff, and noticed her kid being rather cruel to another kid and said to her daughter, you know, you're engaging in bullying. This is not okay, the way you're talking to your friend. And the kid said, how do you even know that I have a right to privacy online? And the mother actually got, for a second, like, you know, convinced by this, like, right to privacy because it sounds so official. And I pointed out to the mother that, you know, right to privacy is an aspect of American law. We have the right to privacy from government intrusion into certain aspects of our private lives. Children don't have a right to privacy on their Facebook, which is, by the way, public, right? Mm-hmm. Like if she has a public Facebook and you're friended on her Facebook, which was a good rule in this case because the mother then saw this interaction, right? Then you have a right to comment on what you saw. You're her parent. Just like if you would overhear her saying something cruel to her friend, you would have something to say to her and you would want to curb that behavior. You saw it online. It's the same thing. You saw it. She doesn't have a right to privacy when it comes to something that's public, right? Of course, our kids have the right to certain types of privacy. I wouldn't read my child's diary. I wouldn't, eavesdrop on something like, you know, if she's whispering to her friend, I wouldn't necessarily eavesdrop on that conversation. But you put something public out there, you know, online for all the world to see, and I see it, I have the right to comment on it. You know, just that ludicrousness. I think nowadays kids are so attached to their phones, humans in general tend to get what they need, right? And if someone's so attached to her phone because, like, I need that, like, dopamine rush of, like, my friend liking my comment or whatever, I need that, then it's going to become an emergency to that kid, and we tend to respond to other people's sense of urgency. So it's easy for the parent to get confused. So I'm very into, like, if you're not going to do anything else in terms of conscious parenting, make sure your kid gets enough sleep. Mm-hmm. And it's not, and I mean, shutting the Wi-Fi signal in the house is not that complicated. There are things you can do, right, that you can enforce that kind of rule very simply. In school, I feel like one thing teachers can do is when the kids come in, start the day with something that lets them get, you know, acknowledge their mood states and get mindful, right? Like, you know, sort of put the morning behind us, whether it was a good morning or a bad morning, and get our minds focused. Like, let's give them, I am very into giving them the gift of mindfulness. Let's do a transitional activity, even if it's a 2-second transitional activity, but let's do that so that then they're primed and ready to learn. That to me is the best way to welcome a kid to school, right?
Mm-hmm. I love that. I mean, that was such a great, I asked a very big question, I feel like, and you just summed it up so beautifully. Yeah, digital bedtime, let's start there. And transitional mindfulness moment, let's start there. Awesome. Okay, Robin, who are you giving an A to these days? It's always one of my favorite questions to ask.
So I have a couple of people I'm giving an A to, not necessarily in the education world. I want to, like, really give an A to the children's authors, specifically Mo Willems, Kevin Hankes, and Anna King, also Amy Krauss Rosenthal. What I love about their children's books, I have this big bias against a lot of the children's books that are coming out nowadays because they're, like, sort of self-help books for adults, but with, like, pretty pictures. So I don't love those books about, like, you know, Johnny talks too loudly and then Johnny meets wise old rabbit who teaches him to lower his voice and now he has more friends. It's a self-help book. It's fine. It's like How to Win Friends and Influence People for 5-year-olds. You know, there's a lot of books like that out there. They're fine. I find it's much more powerful to teach kids when we're entertaining them, we're telling them a story that really is a story, right? You know, the Mo Willems books, the characters are characters. They're having a story. There's no, like, lesson. There's no author standing there saying, like, so therefore you should. Mm. I might come up with a lesson afterwards, but the story is just a story. Anna Kang does a great job of this, and she does a great job of helping kids understand the concept of a dialectical. She has these books where part of the title is the word not in parentheses, like, we are not friends, we are not scared, it is not mine, where it's this great idea of helping kids see things from two different perspectives that's really fabulous. And again, it's a story. There's nothing about social skills in it, but you can learn a lot of social skills. Kevin Hankes does a masterful job of, like, really getting into the minds of kids. His book Chrysanthemum about school bullying is so well done, and it's so real and true to life of what that experience of being called a name feels like when you're 5 years old. Again, with no lessons, not trying to preach, not trying to teach, just entertaining and connecting with kids. Amy Krauss Rosenthal also, great books that really connect with kids without trying to teach them any particular lesson. But then we can talk about lessons if we want to. I'm giving an A to Nir Eyal, who wrote Indistractable. My favorite book. I think we're all human, right? And, like, ultimately, mm-hmm. teachers are human, parents are human, kids are human. We need to learn how to manage this new, very not well understood thing called technology that's in our lives right now. You know, Arianna Huffington is another person who's really pushed the importance of sleep. Just those old fashioned basics. Are you eating enough? Are you eating at the right times of day? Are you eating foods that nourish you? Are you sleeping enough? Are you doing self-care activities, right? People who remind us that, as, you know, cyber as we're becoming, we're still humans. Mm-hmm. And we have to be human. Because ultimately, schools teach us about being human.
Right. So good. As we wrap up, I would love for you to share how people can get connected with you and connected with your work and catch up and benefit from this model in any way possible.
So sure, thanks. I do have a website, targetedparenting.com, and the website does have like clips of workshops and samples of, you know, articles that I've written and, you know, description of the classes. I do offer targeted parenting classes on a webinar format. Targeted parenting is a specific type of parenting class where rather than teaching people how to be great parents, we're teaching them how to parent specific profiles of children very mindfully. So you parent a child who's a natural introvert or a child who gets angry really easily, what we call the reactive child, or the shy child, what we call the careful child, very differently. And the goal of the classes is to teach the specific skills for the specific child. I have another class that I'm loving teaching. I call it post-traumatic parenting. It's about giving your kids a normal childhood when yours was anything but. Because I have so many parents who feel so disempowered because their childhoods were so, you know, not healthy that they don't know how to parent. So the whole goal of the class is to teach them how to parent when now they are living a stable life and they do want to be conscious parents, but their models were really poor. So that class, you know, has really gotten a tremendous, like way more, you know, subscription and way more people taking it than I ever thought possible. I just, you know, taught it more out of a passion. A friend of mine who runs a support organization for people who have lost a parent in their childhood asked me to, you know, write the class, and it's just taken off. So, you know, that's the targeted parenting classes. It's a second step after someone who's taken another parenting class, which is more about the basics of parenting. This is about, okay, I have this kid with ADHD. How do I parent him? You know, I have this kid who's on the spectrum. How do I parent her? You know, so that it's very, very targeted to very specific types of profiles of children. And then I am on Instagram. I'm, you know, at Dr. Kozlowitz Psychology. And I do go live on Instagram every Thursday night at 9 p.m. Eastern Standard Time, where I give like a free parenting class for an hour where we pick a parenting topic. People vote on my Insta what they want to hear about that week. This week we're talking about talking to children about scary events in the news. And where for an hour I just give like a little mini class, and it's free, so everybody can, you know, get a taste of what targeted parenting is like, but also it's my way of giving back, you know, and giving this, you know, information out. And I'm on LinkedIn, so those are, you know, the main ways people can, you know, interact with me, get to know me. I also write a Psychology Today blog. It's called Targeted Parenting. And I also try to pinpoint really interesting research that can inform our parenting. And I always try to give some very specific tips. Like, so based on this, we now know, like I did a whole series on sleep. I recently did a series on, you know, on school bullying. I did a series on, like, one of the most recent ones was on lying to children. There's been a lot of, you know, parents lie to kids sometimes, and I think they're not aware of the level of psychological damage telling a child a lie can do. You know, the kind of lie that's like, you know, if you don't come right now, I'm leaving you in the mall, you know. And so there's actually research that demonstrates just how psychologically harmful it is. So my goal in the blog is always to find that research that really speaks to a real-world parenting dilemma and then bring the lesson home. So therefore, here's something you can consciously do in your own parenting that you can change that will help your child.
Awesome. I feel like I've just been practicing holding back from asking another like two dozen questions because I have them. But I know we'll continue talking.
You know, like I feel like listening to your podcast has been such an eye-opening experience for me because, you know, sometimes, as you say, when you're innovative in education, you do feel very alone because, you know, you don't know that somebody in Wisconsin might be doing something similar that you could collaborate with, you know, and like hearing your podcast and hearing the different, the levels of innovation that is being brought to the education world, it's just such a hopeful thing for those of us who just say, okay, just because it's always been done that way doesn't mean we can't change and do it better.
That's right. Yeah. And I'm so, so grateful to have your voice in this community and on this show and as a part of the conversation. So thank you so much for your time.
Thank you so much for having me. I really enjoyed it.
Thanks for listening to this episode of Off the Assembly Line. Off the Assembly Line is produced by me, Rebecca Reed, with many thanks to the incredible guests who share their stories and knowledge every week. If you're enjoying the show, the two best ways to support it is by rating and reviewing, and then sharing it with someone who needs to hear it. You can find resources and details shared in the episode in the show notes or at offtheassemblyline.co. By the way, if you haven't subscribed to the newsletter yet, you can do that at offtheassemblyline.co as well. How can you lean into possibility this week? Think about that, and then go make a ruckus.